Weekend events include music, food, and entertainment after the run and exist to honor Dr. Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, delivered in Washington, D.C., August 1963, during the March for Jobs and Equality. Again, that's the MLK Dream Run, the weekend of August 1st and 2nd at the corner of Northeast Martin Luther King in Alberta in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Every Monday night at 8 o'clock, you can hear this voice alerting you that
you are about to cross the border.
And then follow the footsteps to a two-hour-long sustained environment of uninterrupted sonic art or new electronic, experimental, or postmodern music. Audio that breaks and rewrites the rules to create entirely new worlds of sound. Where will you be on Mondays at 8 when the door slams shut? Here on KBOO Portland.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad.
They won't build no hospitals. They won't build no schools anymore. They won't build no hospitals. All they build will be prison for some. All they build will be prison for some. All they build will be prison for some.
Good evening, greetings, and welcome to Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Adam Carpinelli. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. Tonight, we are here with two folks, one here live in the studio, local Portland, and also somebody who is down in the Bay Area who we're getting on the phone right now. But we'll start off with you. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm doing good. How are you?
Good, good. Thanks. Can you just let us know your name and what organizations you're with?
Yeah. So I'm Daniel Hong, and I am with Strike Debt Portland, and I'm part of the National Strike Debt Movement that was debuted in 2012, 1 year after, to coincide the 1 year anniversary of Occupy Wall Street. And it's a movement of debtors who are educated about the systemic systemic root causes of debt, financial debt, and is who are united for economic alternatives.
Great. And can you talk about what that looks like here in Portland and what kind of work is going on right now currently?
Yeah, so Strike Debt has this cool model for public education called Debtors Assemblies, and they are free public gatherings for anybody who can join and learn about debt on a systemic level, student loan debt, housing debt, medical debt, hear people's testimonies about, you know, personal stories of how debt affects people's daily lives, and to really eliminate the stigma behind a lot of debt. And so and we're doing education, and we're connected with the national movement organizing debtors to form unions and to build support for to strike against a common creditor.
Great, thanks so much for coming out tonight. We're also on the phone here with Mr. Michael Wilson. Mike, are you there?
Yes. Hi Adam,
how you doing?
Good.
Great. I'm pretty good. Thanks for being on. Daniel just gave an excellent introduction about Strike Debt and Strike Debt Portland and what they're doing. Can you talk a little bit about what's going on in the Bay Area, how people got involved, how they're organizing now?
So currently there are three main projects that Strike Debt Bay Area is working on. One is to expand the availability of low interest rate payday and check cashing services, payday loan and check cashing services. So in Oakland, there is the only not-for-profit payday lending and check cashing enterprise in the country. And we would like to make that spread around the city so it's more available to people who, for one reason or another, can't or choose not to use commercial banking services. And so their only alternative in most cases is these predatory payday lending and check cashing enterprises that charge exorbitantly high interest rates and get people into a debt cycle that they have a very, very hard time getting out of. Another project is our continuing opposition, which has been going on for 2 years, to the privatization of the U.S. Postal Service. We feel that the Postal Service is the only form of communication that's reasonably safe from surveillance these days, and that it's an excellent model for running an enterprise where you don't have to pay huge executive salaries and shareholder dividends, but where all profits are used to make the Postal Services as affordable as possible and available everywhere. Everywhere. And then the third project is we Strike Debt created a couple of years ago the Debt Resistance Operations Manual, which is a book that goes through all the different categories of debt and the dangers that they pose and the tools that people can use to organize to resist those forms of debt collectively and to protect themselves individually as well, and so we're working on translating that into Spanish.
And that is an excellent, very excellent resource for our listeners to be checking out. And on that note, there are all kinds of different debt out there, and some of it is, you know, kind of these historical forms. We have these kind of contemporary forms. There's this change over time with debt, and of course, here on Prison Pipeline, we're always relating things back to mass incarceration, right? And so. Right. Can you all kind of make that connection there as forms of those kinds of forms of debt that really relate directly to not only the prison system, but the history and roots of mass incarceration itself, right? Which is slavery and native genocide and displacement of people's lands from either Africa and or the Americas, and how all that's tied in.
Well, could I start?
Yeah, please do. Thanks.
Yeah. So what's kind of. Well, what's really interesting, kind of predicament that particularly prisoners are facing with is just this a lack of the lack of protections for them if they have any outstanding debt going into prison, whether it be student debt, medical debt, payday loan debt, credit card debt, any loans, forms of debt in their terms and agreements that they have established with their creditor. There's absolutely no clause or protection from them about if the interest rates will continue to compound and that the debt will continue to grow once they're inside jail. Because despite, you know, prisoners having absolutely no means to pay back their loans while they're in prison, because there's no wages. There's no wages in prison. There may be labor, but there's no way for a form of compensation. And yet, despite all that, when many of these prisoners, if they go out of prison, they find themselves to be thousands of dollars in debt more to a bill that they haven't had the access to visit in years, mm-hmm. that they haven't had any means of communication with their creditors to negotiate, their loans. So we have that one aspect, and I think another aspect really is the financial, you know, the financial system kind of backing bail bonds and mm-hmm, fines right. and court fees and all these legal mm-hmm. fees that kind of are cut up in the criminal justice system. We see that local municipalities and police departments are not only one of finding the need, you know, playing on the neat idea of a sort of getting their revenue funding from fining people mm-hmm. on, you know, on traffic tickets, on misdemeanors, on really petty street crimes, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. as a source of public revenue for the city, but also that these fines are tied with interest rates mm-hmm. that there's this debt agreement that has been established between like the police department and mm-hmm. the justice department and the criminal that, well, of course the criminal has no choice to consent to mm-hmm. and that kind of serves as justification for the courts to issue warrants, to threaten arrest, and to really imprison and take as much money away from these low-level offenders as possible.
Right, and then takes all the money out of, you know, public services, right? So it sounds like it's really a big racket whereby we see the intersection of the prison and credit industrial complexes really working very well together. When I say well, not for people, you know, but for profit. Michael, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I would like to tell your listeners, if they don't already know, about Rexdale Henry, who is a Choctaw Indian from Neshoba County, Mississippi. Mm-hmm. And he had an outstanding fine for a traffic violation. And he had failed to appear to contest the traffic violation. And so on July 5th, he was arrested because he was unable to pay the fine. And 9 days later, on July 14th, the day after Sandra Blaine was found hanged in her jail cell, Rexdale Henry was also found dead in his jail cell. Now, I've just checked in the last few minutes to see if there's any results from the autopsy. There still are no results from the autopsy. But here's a case where an indigent person was unable to pay a fine. And so in Mississippi, as well as I think it's 12 other states, they use what's known as the private probation service. Private probation services. Private probation services are set up to collect fines and fees for the state. It's a subcontracted arrangement.
Right.
And in addition to the, so what they'll do is offer someone who is having trouble paying a fine an installment plan for paying it off. Mm-hmm. But what they also add to that is a setup fee and a $45 a month fee for the private company to collect profit from. So this adds to the financial burden that an indigent person, for instance, or a person who has a very low income and is in difficult straits anyway, is going to have trouble making. This just makes the matter worse. Mm-hmm. The alternative is, if you can't pay it, you can go sit in jail. What the private probation services fail to disclose in far too many cases is that the state allows for the person to work the fine off doing community service. Mm-hmm. The reason they don't disclose this and don't make this available is because there's no profit for them in working the fine off doing community services. they want to collect their fees. So this is an instance where the justice system is being privatized, and the harm that it's causing to the people who can least afford to handle it. I mean, the message intended for the individual is, don't do anything wrong and you'll be okay, and right. we won't bother you. But the complexity of our lives has made them impossible to manage in compliance with every statute and regulation. Corporations complain of these obstructions constantly, but the fines and the fees and the defense costs that they incur don't have the same crippling degree of harm that poor folks experience. So justify that if you can.
Right, and I also kind of want to like broaden the kind of the conversation with really kind of on a macro level on seeing really kind of this really where what a kind of financial state we are that the United States is facing. You know, leading up to 2008, there was this kind of big idea of the housing bubble, which is right, exactly. It's investors and investors in a speculative market throwing money around to sell toxic mortgages that were doomed to fail, and that homeowners only were lied to on their terms of their mortgage, the debt would have been odious. It's absolutely impossible to pay back, and these banks and these investors, once the bubble popped, not only got a bailout from the federal government, but were able to kind of justify the foreclosure of millions of Americans of homes, and which kind of continues to this day, and. Kind of really results on why there are still so many empty properties, despite how many houses people there are. There's more housing property in the United States than there are people that could occupy it. And so, I want to transition that to kind of this kind of bubble, another bubble that economists have been following. It's called the student debt bubble. Mm. So student debt has been it's passed its $1.2 trillion point.
Oh my gosh.
$1.2 trillion of debt owed to the federal government for students for a service that prior to the 60s would have been next to nothing,
right.
and would have been publicly funded and would have been accessible for the average American, but now is so prohibitively expensive that people are afraid of going to school, afraid of being educated because of the amount of debt that they would have to take on. Anyways, economists are speculating kind of, that point of the bubble bursting of student debt, going to a collective default, meaning, being too odious to pay. And, kind of the question that I ask is like, well, what does that set up for the federal government to do, and what can they justify now for these student debtors that can't pay back their loans? Homeowners had their houses taken. Will these student debtors have their education repossessed? Will they have their lives repossessed? And that's kind of really where asking the question of how do prisons play into this, because
you're listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. For those of you just tuning in, this is Prison Pipeline. We're here with Daniel Hong and Mike Wilson from Strike Debt Portland and Bay Area Chapters. And Michael, now we're kind of shifting the conversation. We talked a little bit about this kind of debtor's prison and those connections. Now we're talking about, the student debt. Where are the points of intersection here, too? Because I'm thinking there's a lot of points of intersection between, prison, being homeless, being a student, or previously being a student, or previously being in prison, and all these people are having all kinds of different debt all over the place. So where is all this stuff coming together?
Wow. So I guess the
big picture.
Best way that I can formulate that, an answer to that, is to say that privatization of government, not just of government services, but of government protections, mm-hmm. has gotten us into the situation that we're into, the hole that we're falling into now. Mm-hmm. So a decline in tax revenues because corporations and the wealthy have done such a great job of lobbying to have their tax contributions reduced, this has been going on over the past 30 years, has resulted in a privatization, for instance, of the justice system. So parole reentry programs, drug rehab required mm-hmm. by the courts, and electronic monitoring, these costs must be paid by the offenders. And if they can't pay, then they go back to jail. Mm-hmm. This privatization of justice has resulted in a tremendous source of free labor in yes. private prisons,
yes.
which is very profitable for the investors and, you know, the chief financial officers of the corporations that run those prisons. And that makes jail time profitable while it destroys the principle of justice that says we must care for each other, mm-hmm. because if we don't, then we must each create individual fortresses for our own security. Mm. And that's what's happening. That's what the rich are doing. That's what the corporations are doing. I don't know if any of you are familiar with the movie Network, made back in the early 70s, but what is predicted there is coming to fruition now very clearly, which is that if you want security and if you want protection from, from having your goods taken from you, then you have to create that protection for yourself. And you have to do that by preying upon everyone around you that you can get money from. And the goods, the services, the territory, everything that is publicly owned in this country is considered as a great source of revenue because, since we've expanded to the limits of our national borders, all we can do is turn on each other. Mm-hmm. And the wealthy and the corporations have legions of lawyers and experts to make them more effective at doing that. And so they are creating their own fortresses where they don't have to, where they can be safe.
Mm-hmm. And I want to respond with Mike saying, okay, so with kind of expanding on kind of the principles, the values of justice, and really the main one of that, justice is about the common good. It's justice is about what benefits everybody and how people can cooperate and live, live freely and together equally. So, yeah, and where was I going with this? I think let's see. For me, it seems that really debt is used as a modem for control.
Mm-hmm.
And that, really a way to justify the subjugation of another person. And talking about, these debtors' prisons, they also go back to centuries and empires past. The Romans had them. The many of the fiefdoms in medieval Europe also had debtors' prisons. And it... aside from the slavery that that the Americas expert in seizing Africans away from their homelands and continent to deliver them to and sell them into slave owners in another continent. The typical way for one to have slaves was to find debtors who owed labor or wages for mm-hmm. you. Throw them into debtors' prisons and have them be indentured servants and to work for you. So I think the kind of the parallel is very the intersection, I mean, between incarceration, prisons, and debt is kind of very clear, because clearly the creditors are using debt so that people are coerced into labor and coerced into productivity.
Right. So what I hear you saying is that, you know, when it comes to what's called the school to prison pipeline, mm-hmm. we have people who are, in a sense, becoming almost like overeducated in the system, because at the end of the day, you know, whether you're educated or not, right, you know, everybody's kind of under some kind of indentured servitude in some form of debt or another, right? So, Michael, can you talk a little a bit about that, and where kind of what that kind of debt looks like? Daniel mentioned what some of the figures look like as far as the bubble. What does it look like on the ground as far as some other experiences people that are having coming out of school or going into school?
Yeah, sure. So President Obama has said many times, he seems very fond of saying, that the ticket to the middle class is a college education.
Mm-hmm, right.
And so, unfortunately, that's becoming more and more expensive, and something yeah. that people can't afford, and they get locked into debt for generations so that they can pay for, you know, for decades, I mean, so that they can pay off the cost of their job training, which is something that their employers primarily profit from.
Mm-hmm.
And so the thing is that it has become true that the ticket to the middle class is a college education, when there used to be an alternative. See, college isn't for everybody. You know, not all of us can be engineers and scientists, which is what we're being steered, what college students are being steered into if mm-hmm. they want to be able to pay off their student loans.
Mm, right.
If we go that way, then, you know, everybody working in fast food is going to have a degree in engineering in the not too distant future. There used to be an alternative, which was unions.
Mm-hmm.
Joining a union and working in a union made not only a contribution to the welfare of everybody in the union, but made it possible for people to secure loans, buy homes, and send their kids to college and secure a pension. And that was without a so-called college education. Now, if college were geared not only towards these professions like law and medicine, medical technology and engineering and hard science, but were also more geared, as it used to be, towards vocational training after high school, then this would be something that would serve the concept of the union, which is for people who are doing work that is not regarded as a profession, but is nevertheless essential to the community, that they should be able to enjoy a middle-class lifestyle and financial security, and even some levels of financial independence. And so this is something that there are a lot of different ways of going about correcting this, but it also must be said that college education not only should be free, but it can be free.
Mm-hmm. Right,
the costs that are paid by the state in subsidizing loans to college students, the tax breaks that parents get for sending their kids to college, all these things could be repackaged and used to just make college education free for everybody.
Right. Yeah,
so it would have to include a full palette of curricula that everybody could engage in. You know, I mean, I wasn't that great in science, so, you know, mm-hmm. I or in math, I was okay, but you know, I wouldn't want my security to depend on my ability to do math and science.
Yeah.
So I'm a carpenter, and for instance, and so there's no reason why a person working in a trade like that, as I said, is essential to the community, shouldn't be able to enjoy some, at least, financial security.
Right.
Yeah, and I just want to clarify that we're not against education. We're not against, you know, people studying in medicine or law or engineering. No, we're not. what we are against, however, is commodifying education, right, making it inaccessible, and again, making it coercive. Like many of our human needs that are under the debt system, housing and medical, just to name a few. Yeah. We are here. We want to have education be democratically controlled and to benefit the public good.
Yeah, it's like a basic right, right? That's on the equal kind of playing field, if you will, which is kind of contradictory to capitalism itself. You guys, this is just scratching the surface on this, so I think we're going to have to do like a part two in a couple weeks or something. If you guys have time, let's get you back on and keep talking about this stuff, because we do got to close pretty soon. Want to make sure that our listeners are getting the resources. So, Daniel, Michael, can you share, you know, where are people going to check this stuff out? You know, what are the links, Facebook pages, etc.?
Yeah, so we have... Can I start? Yeah.
Go ahead.
So find us on Strike Debt Portland on Facebook. We're a Facebook group, Strike Debt Portland. We have an email list as well that you can just find us under Google Groups. We are going to host teach-ins throughout the day tomorrow at Cathedral Park to coincide the Shell No kayak actions against the oil drilling. We're doing teach-ins on climate debt. Thanks.
Okay, Michael?
As a resource for your listeners, the best thing that I can suggest is that they visit strikedebt.org and check out the Debt Resistors Operations Manual, which is available either in print form, but it's also available as a free download on that website. And in that, if there's certain categories of debt that they're suffering from, they can check those out individually. Or they can look through the whole book, of course. And as I said, it's a free download. So that's a great resource for people. And if anybody is suffering from harassing phone calls from debt collectors, they should check out Strike Debt Bay Area. Google that, and that'll take you to our Tumblr site. And there's a resource there are resources for challenging or getting to the bottom of what's going on. Sometimes debt collectors are fraudulently representing them.